Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Americans have always prided themselves on living in a country that works, that accomplishes what no other nation seems to be able to, and that acts as a shining beacon of freedom and democracy. But if you're honest with yourself, you'd admit that something has changed. If you're old enough, you remember when Republicans and Democrats could go to the county commission or the state capitol or to Washington, work together, compromise, and get things done. Things that reflected the views and desires of those who sent them into that political office. Well, no more. Today, we have deadlock, bickering, two sides that can't tolerate each other. And the result is that little is accomplished, and what legislation does slip through doesn't seem to be what most Americans want. It wasn't supposed to be that way. So how do we fix it? Our guest this hour has some ideas, and thankfully he doesn't believe it would be all that hard to change things, but the clock is ticking. David Litt went to the White House in 2011 as a speechwriter and left in 2016 as a senior presidential speechwriter and special assistant to Barack Obama. But he's not all serious all the time. He's written jokes to be delivered at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. He also was head writer for Funny or Die in Washington for a period. And he's put his funny bone to work in his latest book, tackling a very serious subject, which makes it an entertaining and interesting read. The book is Democracy in One Book or Less, How It Works, Why It Doesn't, and Why Fixing It is Easier Than You Think. And David Litt joins us for the hour. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. When and why did you decide? This is your second book, I believe. So when and why did you decide to write this one?
I decided to write this book because I had this idea that was just worming its way in my brain and wouldn't go away. And the idea or the thing that I noticed was that on all of these different issues, whether it's gun violence prevention or climate change or healthcare or taxes, you know, we tend to talk about being a divided country, but when you look at what Americans want, we actually agree on the big picture on almost all of these important issues. And yet, despite the fact that we live in a democracy, our government isn't doing what we want. And in many cases, our government is actually doing the opposite of what we want. So that dilemma underlies everything. It's not just an issue, you know, no matter what you care about most, that dilemma almost certainly characterizes the issue that you care about.
I was going to say, even if people don't really understand that, do you think that's responsible for this undercurrent of anger that seems to be permeating the country?
Absolutely. I think one of the most important things to understand about American life right now is that overwhelmingly, we agree that our representative democracy does not represent us. And that's not just true of Democrats like myself. Republicans feel that way. Independents feel that way. More than 80% of the country does not trust Washington to do the right thing. And when I was a kid, that number was about 50-50. So it's really slipped in a fairly short amount of time. And it's not surprising. People are right. Washington isn't doing the right thing.
But how much of the frustration about, or the perception that Washington can't get anything done, or that Washington isn't doing the right thing, or that Washington is the problem, not the solution, is coming from one political party and one television network and a couple of radio commentators, and it's coming on a daily basis, and it's been coming on a daily basis for years, and so over time, you begin to believe that.
I would say what Americans are right about when we think that Washington isn't working is not that Washington can't do anything. Washington, for example, passed a tax bill that overwhelmingly benefited rich people earlier in this president's term. When President Obama was in office, Washington got a lot of big, important things done. You know, the Affordable Care Act, the stimulus and getting us out of the Great Recession, all sorts of stuff. But what we've generally seen, and the way I think about it is, if you're casting your first vote in the 2020 election, your entire lifetime, you've either had dysfunctional government under Democrats, where it's too difficult to accomplish things the people want, or disastrous government under Republicans, where the government is doing the opposite of what the people want, And you're now looking at yet another term that is ending in a total failure. So no wonder young people in particular are so skeptical that America can deliver on its promises.
Hmm. You say, and this kind of plays into what we're just talking about, that if you're a member of Congress, I wrote this book for you. But if you go to the occasional rally or volunteer for campaign, or even just take voting seriously, I wrote this for you as well. So if members of Congress need to read this book, is that part of what's wrong with democracy?
I actually don't think that the problem, and maybe you should never ask an author whether the problem is people needing to read your book, because I will never answer yes to that question. I would say one of the things that almost none of us know, I certainly did not know until I started researching for this book, is the full story of American democracy, both the recent history, how we got to this point, but also our past. So just to give you one example, I was talking about the book a year ago or so with a member of Congress, and I was talking with him about immigrants and voting, because it turns out immigrants in most of America at one point or another had voting rights. And he had no idea, but I didn't fault him for that. Most people, including me before I started doing the research, had no idea. There's all sorts of things about the basic machinery of our democracy that we take for granted, but are actually either new or they're different or they're always being debated. So I think, you know, I would be more than happy if members of Congress want to pick up the book.
So how did you research this? How did you find out the things that you didn't know, aside from rereading the Constitution and maybe the Federalist Papers?
Well, there were two main avenues that I took here. One was I did a lot of travel and a lot of talking to experts. So, for example, and part of that was just to keep things fun, because this is a book for people like me. You know, I cannot get through a big, dense book that, you know, could double as a doorstop or a blunt object, right? So
but your book is 347 pages long.
That's true. But, you know, the way that I thought about this, like, I don't know if you ever read A Short History of Nearly Everything, Bill Bryson's book about all of science. That was kind of what I was thinking about with politics. So It's a big book, but my hope is that, you know, when you're done with it, you'll say, oh, that's read like a shorter book. And the reason I did that was because that's the kind of book I like to read. So I did a lot of, when I wanted to learn about long lines at the polls, I found my own long lines. I went to Disney World. Or when I wanted to explore Mitch McConnell's role in our democracy, I tried to crash a party at his old frat house in Kentucky. But I also talked to a lot of legitimate experts, professors, lawyers, people who are involved in this day to day. And then a lot of it was just a matter of, it was pretty rare and very lucky that for 2.5 years, my job was to get up in the morning and go down rabbit holes involving our political process. And they led to some really interesting places.
You've already identified yourself as a Democrat. I mentioned that you worked in the Obama White House, and you just mentioned Disney World, a place that you went on Inauguration Day in 2016 because you thought that it was going to be the only place on the planet that would not be televising the inaugural ceremonies. So let's be clear about all this from the get-go. And I have to ask, is this book more than sour grapes? I mean, do you think that Trump fans could read this book and agree that something has gone wrong and that your prescriptions for fixing it might be right?
So I would say there's certainly, some sour grapes in there. I point out a few points where I say this is not just about complaining, but a little bit it's about complaining. Most of what I care about, though, is not replacing a country that is trending toward a one-party democracy in favor of Republicans. I don't want to see a one-party democracy in favor of Democrats, because that's not a democracy. What I want to see is a country where the basic idea that, you and I learned about in Schoolhouse Rock, right, that if a bill, has popular support and it gets through committee and it can become a law, that's what I want to see. And it doesn't matter which party is in charge. And I think that throughout, I tried really hard. I don't think Mitch McConnell, for example, is going to read my book and say, David, you're right. Everything I've done for the last 30 years is wrong and borderline evil. I just don't see that happening. But I do think a lot of people, there are so many Republicans who do look at what our government is doing, and they agree something isn't working. There's something doesn't feel right. And I think that when you read through this stuff, you start to see that democracy is a bipartisan issue among voters. I mean, voters want to see it made easier for people to vote. voters want to see our campaign finance system change so that money has less influence in politics. These are not partisan issues among voters, but they have become partisan among politicians.
But do you think that political parties would agree with what you just said? You said you don't want to see Democrats being one party control either, because that's not a democracy. But that's what the tendency is right now. The Republicans are the majority party in Washington. They're the majority party in a lot of state houses around the country, and they are pushing through their agenda. The Democrats would do exactly the same thing. Are we talking about degrees of variance here, or completely different philosophies? Do Democrats really want to have a debate with Republicans and vice versa?
Let me tell you just one small example of ways in which the two parties, and again, this is not the voters, but it's the politicians, their attitudes toward democracy itself are wildly different. There's some evidence that if your name goes first on the ballot, right? If you and I are running against each other and your name is listed first, that actually benefits you, you know, up to a couple of percentage points, depending on the race that we're running in. California, which is controlled by Democrats, saw this evidence, and they have an incredibly complicated system to randomize in different counties, different precincts, the ballot order to make sure there's no bias in favor of anybody. Florida, which is controlled by Republicans, has a law in place that said, or I think had until recently, a law in place that said, if your party wins one election, you get to list all your candidates first on the next election to lock in power for Republicans. So the question is, do you think you can win elections in the old-fashioned way with your ideas and by persuading people and with your messaging? Or do you think you can win elections by subtly but aggressively rewriting the rules in your favor? And I don't think the parties are the same when it comes to that question. I think that both parties approach that question differently.
And there are probably other instances of what you just mentioned in Florida, and there certainly are in North Carolina. And it always has seemed to me to be very short-sighted thinking, because you're not necessarily always going to be the party in power. And if you set things up so that as long as you're in power, things favor you, at one point you're not going to be, and then you're going to be up the creek without a paddle. And even Mitch McConnell said this yesterday. He was warning about Democrats who might take control of the Senate getting rid of the filibuster. You'll regret it if you do it, he said. Don't tinker with the Senate rules. Well, he's done that 1,000 times.
Yeah, so usually a good sign that something would be pretty good for Democrats is if Mitch McConnell comes out strongly against it. It's not an ironclad rule, but he's not acting in good faith there. What he's saying is, if you got rid of the legislative filibuster, my best tool for obstructing your agenda would be gone. And I go into this in a lot of detail in the book. If the legislative filibuster didn't help Mitch McConnell, he would have gotten rid of it a couple of years ago.
And you write about the filibuster and how the founding fathers knew nothing about it, would not recognize it as being a thing, because a lot of things that go on in Washington are simply rules put forth by people in the House or people in the Senate. They are not in the Constitution. They were not in the Federalist Papers. They were not in the minds of the founding fathers. So what really matters here? I mean, why is it so difficult to come up with some conformity in these chambers?
Well, to be very clear, I don't think that it's a bad thing that we're constantly debating the rules. I think that's one of the beautiful things about being American. It's one of the amazing things about democracy, is that, you know, none of this was handed down from on high. And even our founders said the structure of government is directly responsible for the benefits of government. And so thinking about the right kind of government and how it should work, that's a quintessentially American thing. We're always trying to debate the rules and make them work better.
David Litt is our guest. His book is called Democracy in One Book or Less, How It Works, Why It Doesn't, and Why Fixing It is Easier Than You Think. We'll talk about all of those ideas in the book, well, not all of them, but many of them, when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is David Litt, former speechwriter for Barack Obama. His book is called Democracy in One Book or Less, How It Works, Why It Doesn't, and Why Fixing It is Easier Than You Think. You say that it appears we are heading toward becoming an illiberal democracy where the people can choose their leaders as long as the ruling party remains in change or in charge, rather, excuse me. And that doesn't sound like democracy to me. That sounds like a dictatorship. You also say this is easy to fix, but the clock is ticking. We're running out of time. Why are we running out of time?
I think one of the trends that unfortunately we are seeing throughout the world right now, not just in the United States, is that authoritarians used to stage coups and now they make sales pitches, right? Winston Churchill said, democracy is the worst form of government ever invented, except for all the others that have been tried. This is kind of an inverted version of that. You see this in the Philippines. You see it in Brazil. You see it in Hungary. You see strongmen saying, well, democracy is the worst form of government you've ever experienced. Why not try something else? And the problem with totalitarianism and authoritarianism is you don't get a return policy. Once you've decided to give up your power in a democracy, you don't get it back. Even if you've decided you've made a mistake. And I think that is in danger of happening in the United States. We're already seeing it in some states. You know, Wisconsin is an excellent example. North Carolina, I think, is certainly on the brink in many ways, where the rules governing democracy are so designed to keep one party in charge that you end up with democracy in name only, or at least you end up very close to democracy in name only.
So this has happened over a period of time, and many of us have been like the frog in the pot of boiling water. We really haven't noticed it. So if time is of the essence to fix this before it can't be fixed, how long would that take? Because it's taken us a while to get here. If Democrats and Republicans used to compromise and now they can't even tolerate being in the same room together, how do we fix this?
I focused on the changes to our democracy and the backslide that has occurred more or less in my lifetime, which is 33 years so far. However, undoing a lot of those changes would be potentially something you could do very quickly. You know, I don't think that fixing democracy is easy. I was very careful. You know, on the book cover, there's a caveat, right? In true speechwriter fashion, it's why fixing democracy is easier than you think. And the reason I think it's easier than you probably think is that what you need is what I call in the book a Skywalker window. So it's like the end of episode 4 of Star Wars, where Luke Skywalker's headed toward the Death Star, and you get a tiny little opening, and the opportunity doesn't last. But if you make that shot, everything changes very quickly. If in 2021 you had a House, Senate, and White House that were committed to fixing our democracy, they could do that in 6 months. That wouldn't be perfect. We'll never have a perfect country. But they could undo 80% of the changes. And, you know, I'm using that as a ballpark, but roughly 80% of what we've seen happen that has made us less small D democratic, they could undo in 6 months.
But would that have to be Democrats in charge of all both houses of Congress and the White House? Or could do you see a scenario where Democrats and Republicans could work toward that end?
I see that as Democrats having the power to pass laws.
But then how is that different from the Democrats simply putting their stamp and making democracy their brand versus the Republicans' brand?
Well, let me give you an example that has nothing to do with democracy. If you or I and I were in a foot race, you know, 100-yard dash, and you say, well, I'm going to give myself a 10-yard head start, I could do, because when you get to rewrite the rules, but then now I get the chance to rewrite the rules. I could do a couple of things. I could say, well, I'm going to give myself a 20-yard head start. So there. And that's what you're describing. That would be not just unfair, but it would threaten the integrity of the competition. Or I could say, I'm going to use my power, my newfound power, to move you back so that we're both on the same place again. And that takes a lot of restraint. But restraint has always been at the heart of a democracy ever since George Washington voluntarily gave up power. And it was ever since he stepped down from the presidency, that idea of saying, I could go further, I could seize more power, but I choose not to, is without that, a democracy will not function. And right now, I hate to say this, but I think that one political party understands that idea, and the Republican Party of Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump clearly do not.
But they also seem to understand the levers of power better than the Democrats, or they're certainly more willing to use them. One of the criticisms that Democrats have always faced is that they're not really a political party. They are just a coming together of these different factions that can't agree on where to go, whereas the Republicans are hyper-focused on what their goal is. And if you live in that world and you want to take power again, or if you get power again, don't you have to play by their rules if you want to achieve anything?
Well, it's funny. Yeah, there's the old Will Rogers quote. You know, I belong to no organized political party. I'm a Democrat.
I'm a Democrat. Yeah.
And I've certainly felt that way many times in my life in politics. But I think at the same time, the Democratic Party is a big tent. And by the way, I love that the Democratic Party is a big tent. That's one of the things that makes me proud to be a Democrat. That said, it does not matter which issue or which area or what focus brings you to caring about politics. If our democracy doesn't work, none of it will work. And any change we make, no matter how big it seems, will ultimately not last forever or probably not last that long. So my view, and the reason that I spent so much time thinking about this specific issue and wrote this specific book, is that no matter what you care about, this should unite all of us. And this should be all of our top priority, to say the democracy we have needs to be able to deliver on its promise that we can shape our future. And then from there, let's argue about what happens next. We should argue. That's healthy. But if we can't shape our future, none of it works.
So let's talk about some of the things you write about in this book. And one of the key things about being an American and about living in a democracy is the right to vote. We don't make participating in our democracy very easy, and certainly not as easy as some other Western democracies. And we'll get into that in a while. But there's an enormous number of people in this country who do not vote. As you point out in the book, the United States has more non-voters, both in sheer numbers and as a percentage of the population, than nearly every developed democracy on Earth. And you mentioned that in 2016, if the turnout rate here had equaled that in France, our electorate would have grown by 30 million people. We're behind all these countries, slightly ahead of Latvia. Why?
There's a short answer to that question and a long answer. So let me start with the short answer. Turnout in America is low because politicians don't want everybody to vote. That's the simple answer. The longer answer is, if you look at the way that American elections are structured, in most other countries, voting is considered a public good. And in America, most of us consider voting a public good. 70% of us in a recent poll said that high turnout is good for our democracy. So it's hard to get to 70% on anything in a country as divided as this one. We still agree high turnout is good, but we don't rely on the government to provide it. We don't rely on the public sector to provide that public good like they do in other countries. Instead, we rely on political parties to do the right thing when it comes to managing our elections and encourage turnout. And that works in some cases because some people want turnout to be high, but other people want turnout to be low because they think they're going to win elections if turnout is lower. So they do all sorts of things to make voting more difficult than it otherwise should be, and much more difficult than it is in most other developed democracies.
But, you know, could it be that we've settled into some bad habits here? I'm older than you, and so I remember the days when Democrats and Republicans could compromise. I remember these great people in the Senate, these legends in the Senate, who would come together, and they were both political parties, and they could reach an agreement on things. And a lot of things were accomplished as a result of that. Roads were built. We went to the moon. Great society was created. Other things happened. And so when you look at that government and you see things working, maybe you don't need to vote. Maybe, you know, it's working. I don't have to go to this election. I can play hooky this time around. And that becomes part of your habit going forward. And suddenly things stop working. Is that part of what's happened here?
I don't think it's really part of what's happened, because if you look at the reasons people don't vote, I mean, that has been an argument through American history, especially recent history. Conservatives in particular have said maybe Americans don't vote because they're just so happy with the political process. You know, they don't think politics really affects their lives. Well, when you ask people why they don't vote, they generally have preferences. They generally do actually support one candidate over another in an election. They just don't turn that preference into a vote. Now, some people don't vote, lots of people don't vote, because they think their vote doesn't matter, which is a different question. If, for example, I'm voting in a congressional district under North Carolina's former congressional map that has been gerrymandered to the point where the map decides who represents me and my vote doesn't have much impact, then I am more likely to say, why bother with the hassle? Because my vote doesn't really matter. That is something we're seeing, but that's something we can change.
Is that why you say people don't vote? Because their leaders don't want them to, because their leaders have rigged the system, gerrymandered the system to favor one party over the other. So if you're the party out of favor and you go to vote for that candidate, it doesn't matter.
Well, that's part of the reason. But on the most basic level, what politicians are doing is making the act of voting extraordinarily difficult in an unprecedented way. So just to give you two quick examples, between the 2014 and 2016 election cycles, so that's just two-year cycles, 16 million Americans were what's called purged from the voter rolls. In other words, registered Americans were taken off the voter rolls. Some of them had died. Some of them had moved. So not all of those were eligible voters. But a conservative estimate would say about 2.7 million of those people were eligible to vote, and we took them off the voter rolls. And that's not random. Disproportionately, those voters were non-white. They were lower income. They were younger. And another really quick example, between 2008 and 2016, more than 10% of polling places in America closed. And those closures disproportionately affected minority neighborhoods. And so when you look at these incredibly long lines that we're seeing them in primary elections around the country this year, but we've seen them for years. They're not accidents. This is happening in part because people actively are trying to mismanage elections to make it harder for certain people to vote.
I want to follow down both of those roads. Let's start with what we've been witnessing in recent months, and that is elections that don't work. I grew up thinking we had the best election system in the world. They were fair. They were focused. If you cast a ballot, it was going to be counted. And ever since the Hanging Chad incidents with Gore and Bush, that's been in question. And increasingly, we see people standing in these incredibly long lines. We see voting machines that suddenly don't work on election day. We see poll workers who have been untrained. They don't know how to cope with what's going on at the voting booth. That can't be a mistake.
It's not a mistake. I mean, I will say managing elections is difficult, and it's not just a red state problem. So I want to be very clear about that. But what we've seen in red states in particular is the intentional mismanagement of the elections. And you pointed out you grew up kind of thinking our elections work pretty well. I did too. I think that's probably because we're white people. If you're coming from a non-white majority neighborhood, there's a pretty high chance that you're looking at long lines at the poll saying, yeah, this has been happening for a very long time. I mean, to compare this with another example where Americans are realizing that there's been a problem, but a lot of us knew this problem and were living it for a long time. We've seen these videos of police brutality and police violence in recent months and recent weeks. And I think for a lot of us, it was eye-opening. And also for a lot of us, they said, yeah, this isn't news at all. We knew this was happening. I think we're seeing the same thing election after election. These videos of people, I mean, we just had a primary election in Kentucky where you had people banging on the door, demanding to be let in to vote. I mean, people waiting in line, you know, having to literally pound on the door to go cast a ballot. And unfortunately, I think what we're learning is not that this is a new problem, although people are making it worse. I think what we're learning is this is a problem that's always existed, and we haven't done enough about it.
You mentioned a few seconds ago about the 16 million people that had been disenfranchised. They've been purged from the voter rolls. I think it was 2014 to 2016, you said. About 22.5 million people were legally barred from voting in the last election. So put that number into perspective. That's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people. I mean, it's a population the size of Texas. And when I was growing up, this is the important thing on all these dimensions, is not just that it's a big number, but that it's the new, that it did not used to be this big. When I was growing up, roughly 3.5% of Americans, or when Reagan first was elected president, roughly 3.5% of Americans had no voting rights. And today that number is up to about 8.8%. So we're pushing toward 10%. There's two big reasons for that. One is what's called felony disenfranchisement laws. Those are laws that say if you've ever committed a felony in our state, you can never vote. That's a direct legacy of Jim Crow. Those laws came out of the 1860s. When Southern legislators were looking for ways to disenfranchise black voters when you couldn't do it through slavery. That has taken a lot of people out of the electorate. The other thing that is less remarked on is that we have now gone longer than at any time in modern history without providing immigrants a pathway to citizenship. And our legal immigration process, there's an enormous backlog. So when you add all that up, you have millions upon millions of immigrants, where in the past we would have found some way to say you can earn your citizenship and therefore your voting rights. And instead, we're keeping people from voting. And that political power is the real reason that we have immigration as such a flashpoint in the country. Before it became people became worried about new citizens voting, immigration used to be a bipartisan issue.
I want to put that 22 and a half million people into a different shine a different light on it, because you do in one of the pieces that you wrote, you say it's the equivalent of barring every single person in Alaska, Hawaii, Idaho, D.C., Nebraska, Delaware, Wyoming, Kansas, West Virginia, Vermont, North Dakota, Mississippi, South Dakota, New Hampshire, Montana, Rhode Island, Maine, New Mexico, and Utah. None of them would be able to vote if they were all in that 22 and a half million people. That is astounding.
It's a remarkable number. And I have to say, you know, that's the kind of thing that I certainly did not know before I started writing this book. I knew there were problems, and I knew that we kept people from voting. Otherwise, I wouldn't have gone into this project in the first place. But I still, over and over again, was just shocked by how big these numbers are and how new these big numbers are. This is changing, and it's changing in the wrong direction in nearly every case.
You also talk about North Carolina, and we've had our series of troubles with the legislature trying to gerrymander districts and change polling places and polling hours and days of the week that early voting takes place. And you say that it's made it more difficult, particularly for Democrats, to vote here. You say that white North Carolinians who tend to vote Republican had to travel in total about 21,000 more miles to vote because of these changes, which is not a good thing. But it is 0.004 miles per person. But black North Carolinians who tend to vote Democrat had to travel an extra 350,000 miles to vote, or 2.5 more miles per trip per person. Deliberately, correct? We have 20 seconds.
I think it's deliberate. You can never prove this stuff, and that's part of why it's so sneaky. But you have to just look at it over and over again and say, in case after case, one group of people most likely to vote for one party is being disenfranchised. I don't think that's a coincidence.
David Litt is our guest. His book is called Democracy in One Book or Less, How It Works, Why It Doesn't, and Why Fixing It is Easier Than You Think. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. David Litt is with us. He's the author of Democracy in One Book or Less. We talked about making it harder to vote and also making it more useless to vote in ways through gerrymandering. But gerrymandering is something that has been done by both political parties down through time. The Democrats did it here in North Carolina when they were in power. The Republicans certainly have done it since they've been in power. How do you stop that? How do you reverse it?
I should start by saying, when you look at the impact of gerrymandering, you're 100% right. Both parties have engaged in it over time. But the overall effect of gerrymandering is greater now than it's ever been. So a University of Chicago law school study, they went back and they looked at the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s. And what they found was that gerrymandering went from favoring Democrats to favoring Republicans, in both cases, noticeably, but slightly, not in any major way. Then you get to 2010 and everything changes. I mean, they said gerrymandering today is unprecedented in its scope and skew. And what they meant by that is, they found that gerrymandering on average is benefiting the Republican Party by one seat per state. We've never seen anything like that before. I'm going to put that in a slightly different way for your listeners. Maps determine who represent us and people do not, to an extent we have never seen before in our lifetimes. So that's the first thing. We should recognize that this is happening to a degree that makes it fundamentally different than in the past. And then the second thing is, you need to figure out how to get, in my view, the way to do it is you figure out how to get states run by Democrats and states run by Republicans to agree to dismantle their gerrymandering schemes together. Because that way, you're not asking politicians to give up power, which they're usually reluctant to do. But at the same time, you're promoting fairness for everybody. So if you had a state like a Georgia and a state like a Virginia hold hands and say, we're going to set up commissions that are going to draw fair districts, that would make a big difference. And it wouldn't hurt either party. And I think that's the important thing, because ultimately you have to figure out how to get politicians to make these decisions.
Why do we leave it into the hands of politicians? Obviously, they have to make a law. If they make this a national law saying gerrymandering it can't be done and we have to have election nonpartisan election commissions draw the boundaries, that requires politicians to do that. Will they ever do that? Because that's giving up power. Only the party out of power wants the gerrymander to go away.
That's not actually the case. I mean, if you look at California, if you look at New Jersey, a variety of other states, and again, I'm a Democrat, but the fact just is that these are predominantly blue states, although Arizona is another good example, they already have nonpartisan commissions in place. So you do see situations where politicians are willing to give up some potential power in favor of having the system work. And it's also important to note that until recently, you could go to the federal courts to try to overturn gerrymanders. But the Roberts Court just in 2019 issued a decision basically saying, nope, we're going to close that avenue to you. You can still go to state courts in some places, including North Carolina. So when you try to wrap your head around all of it, I think the most important thing to recognize is we have 50 different state systems, and the state you live in has a lot to do with what options are available to you, and also the political culture in terms of whether or not you can convince people to give up some power in order to preserve the democracy as a whole.
Let's talk about representation without representation, because once we vote and we send people to Raleigh or to Washington as elected officials, they are there to represent us, to do our bidding. And yet you say that is not what happens. You say there is a large and growing gap between what Americans want and what their government does. Give me some examples.
Well, I would say we'll just throw out a couple of them. But one of the biggest examples, and this came up a lot when I worked in the Obama White House, is on gun violence. Background checks for firearms purchases. This is a policy with an extraordinary amount of support, easily 80% plus. And when you get to 80% plus, you're not just talking about Democrats and independents, you're talking about Republicans supporting it as well. And yet, it's not happening. It seems like it will almost certainly never happen, certainly not under this Congress. And unless the legislative filibuster that we talked about, the 60 vote threshold for passing legislation, disappears, it will never happen. The DREAM Act is another excellent example. So the vast majority of Americans support protecting young people who were brought to this country as children, but they were brought here illegally. Most Americans support protecting those people from deportation, but Congress still wouldn't pass that law. And you see that happen on issue after issue after issue. And the important distinction that I want to make here is it's not the populists versus the elitists, because the popular support is on one side and the expert opinion is on the same side. We're seeing that now with the COVID pandemic. You know, most people support wearing masks. Most experts support wearing masks. And in state after state, our politicians are the ones who are letting us down. That does not make sense if in a functioning democracy.
And if you look at polls on various issues from COVID-19 to climate change to income inequality, I think you will find in most cases the American people, by and large, are on one side and the Republicans are on the other, and they've kind of locked themselves into being a minority party. And this extends to the Supreme Court, where and to the court system in general, where their influence is going to be felt for a very long time because of what's been happening in the Trump administration with filling court positions that were left unfilled by the Senate during the Obama administration. You say the Supreme Court is one area in which the country is pushed farther to the right than most voters want it to go. And you put out a series of tweets on Tuesday about the John Roberts Court. Can you take us through that thread?
Absolutely. Although I feel like nothing good ever begins with you put out a series of tweets, but I will try. So I think because it's interesting that this term in particular, we've seen a number of high profile decisions that have left liberals feeling very happy. So barring discrimination against LGBTQ people in the workplace, protecting DACA, the program that protects Dreamers for the time being, at least. And then finally, overturning a Louisiana law that was essentially designed to shut down abortion clinics. Mm-hmm. My view is that is a sign of two things. Number one, John Roberts is very politically savvy. He's not a politician, but he wants the court to be a powerful force in American life. he recognizes that if the court is seen as overly political and seen as overly partisan, reformers are going to start to question his power, and they might expand the court. So he's trying to keep that from happening. And number two, he's very conservative. So he wants to move the court and the country to the right, but he doesn't want it to seem like he's doing it in a partisan way. So if you look at all three of these big rulings, all of them were decided on these very narrow grounds, sometimes on technicalities. In the case of DACA, what John Roberts said was not that Dreamers should be protected. He basically said to the Trump administration, try again next time, you know, do a little bit more homework and come back to us. So what we're seeing is these small decisions on small things, but then big decisions on the structure of our government itself. Citizens United, gutting the Voting Rights Act, making it impossible to sue in federal court over gerrymandering. These decisions that determine who controls our country, there the Roberts Court is not giving any ground. And so to me, I think what Roberts is doing is recognizing that there's some political pressure. He's trying to decide a few high-profile cases in liberals' favor while beneath the surface deciding as much as possible in favor of conservatives in ways that are going to shape the country for decades. And the question will be whether progressives sort of take this consolation prize, which is pretty meager when you think about everything else going on, or whether they say these are great rulings, but they shouldn't have to happen this way. We should be able to do this through the legislative process, and we shouldn't have to be desperately hoping the court overturns restrictive abortion law that we all agreed was unconstitutional just 4 years ago.
Is that your suspicion, or is that something anybody could glean from a reading of the facts?
I would answer somewhere in between there. I think that's something that most reasonable people, to use a sort of legal standard, could glean from a reading of the facts. And I think it's important to note, and this was something I really dove into, the history of the court, of the Supreme Court, is a history that shows that the court responds to popular opinion and political pressure and to reform attempts. So one of the reasons I believe that Roberts is moving a little bit to the left, or at least willing to side with liberals occasionally, is because he knows that there is more and more pressure to reform the court. Now, I don't think that's a sign that the pressure should diminish. I think it's a sign it's working. And I think that's ideally you want the court to demonstrate that it doesn't need to be reformed by acting responsibly. That would be the best scenario we could imagine.
I believe it's accurate to say that you are an advocate of getting rid of the Electoral College. And a lot of Democrats after the last election would fall into that camp. And the Electoral College does seem to help Republicans more than it helps Democrats. Why do we have one? And how difficult would it be to get rid of it?
I want to be very clear, actually. The Electoral College doesn't help Republicans more than it helps Democrats. It helped Trump in 2016. It seems likely it will help him again in 2020. But in 2012, the president I worked on Barack Obama's reelection campaign, and he could have lost the popular vote by about 1.5% and still won the Electoral College. So no question, the Electoral College would have benefited Democrats that year. I still think we should get rid of it. And the reason is, if you look at the Electoral College, it doesn't really accomplish anything that it's supposed to accomplish. It doesn't actually benefit small states in any meaningful way. It certainly doesn't benefit rural states. If you look at Arkansas or Vermont, presidential candidates are not showing up there. The only thing the Electoral College benefits, the only group, is battleground states. And the number of battleground states has been shrinking. So, 60 years ago, more than half the country lived in a swing state. Today, it's about 25%, sometimes a little bit less. And so what we're seeing is the same pattern we're seeing over and over and over again, which is a small slice of Americans have their preferences elevated, and the vast majority of us have our preferences ignored. And that does not seem like a good recipe for a democracy. And again, this is not me talking as a Democrat. If I found out tomorrow that Joe Biden was, way ahead in the Electoral College, I still would want to get rid of the Electoral College. I don't think it's a good idea.
And something else that doesn't seem to be representative, at least anymore, of the country is the Senate. You call the Senate a threat to democracy itself. I'm sure there are many reasons for that. But one reason that the country is more liberal than the government is because of the Senate. You say American states are more conservative than America's people. And that shows up in the Senate because every state gets two senators. So a very conservative state has two, and there are probably more conservative states than there are liberal states, but there are more people living in those liberal states than in the conservative states. You can't fix that, can you?
Well, I you certainly can't fix it. And I wouldn't say you'd want to, you know, fix isn't necessarily the word that I would use. But I do think, you know, if you're listening to this and you just take one thing away about American politics that will help you understand everything, the thing I would suggest is remember that Donald Trump won 30 states. He won 60% of the states, even though he lost the popular vote. And that because of the Senate, we have a government that represents states rather than people. And suddenly a lot of things start to make a lot more sense. Now, that is a part of the Constitution we can't even change by amendment. That rule that every state gets the equal number of senators, that is the one thing you cannot amend the Constitution to change. We'd have to rip up the whole document and start over, which I don't think is a good idea. I do think we should be admitting Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico as states, both because it's the right thing to do and because it would help counterbalance the Republican advantage in the Senate as it currently stands. I want to be very clear. It would not undo that advantage. Republicans would still have a huge head start in the Senate. It would just pull back that head start a tiny bit while enfranchising hundreds of thousands in the case of D.C. and millions in the case of Puerto Rico, more Americans.
So if you could control the levers of power and start working on some of the fixes that you recommend, that you say are easier than you think, where would you begin?
Well, I think you have to begin, first of all, you have to begin by winning the House, Senate, and White House. I think that's essential. Once you have done that, I think you then most likely need to eliminate the legislative filibuster. I think that's just a given. Once you have done all of that, and again, I want to be very clear, that takes a lot of political will, but it's not essential in the sense, it's not difficult in the sense of you could do it in 15 minutes or, you know, a couple of days if you wanted to. Once you have done that so that you can actually pass laws, there's a huge number of things you can do by passing a single law. You could make voter registration automatic. You could end the voter purges we talked about earlier in the hour that are really sweeping and taking people off the rolls. You could have standards that require a certain number of polling places per voter so that it's easier to vote and you see fewer long lines. You could change our campaign finance system to beef up public financing and undo some of the damage caused by Citizens United. You could make DC and Puerto Rico states. You could expand the Supreme Court, and you could do all of that with a single federal law, and you could pass it in, you know, a matter of days, a matter of weeks. And I think we should.
So that's a possibility, I would imagine, if Democrats gain control of both houses and the White House. So would Joe Biden, would Nancy Pelosi, and would a new Senate Majority Leader in the person of Chuck Schumer agree with you on those things?
We'll see. I hope they read the book afterward. I think they might. I think that something that really encourages me is that we're seeing institutionalists recognize that to preserve your institutions, you have to change them. And I am an institutionalist. I believe in our institutions, but that's why you have to keep them updated and you have to make sure that they don't get disintegrated from without. So if you look, for example, at Senate Democrats have shown a willingness to undo the filibuster that you would not have seen before. They're not 100% on board, but they're saying we're not going to put up with just unlimited obstruction again. This is on the table. Joe Biden recently tweeted about his support for DC statehood. That didn't used to be a top tier issue for Democrats. It is now. So I think we are seeing a recognition within the Democratic Party and within the country more broadly that the way to change a political process that has broken down is to be active in fixing it. We can't just sit there and wait for things to improve on their own. We're going to have to take some steps. And those steps are not radical. They're reasonable. They're just big.
We have just scratched the surface, and I wanted to ask you about how you restore norms that have been trampled in the last 3.5 years that many of us thought were codified, but it turns out, no, it was the honor system that's been trampled on here, but we don't have time for an answer for that. Maybe that's another book for you. David Litt, former speechwriter for Barack Obama, Democracy in One Book or Less. Thank you for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.